My name is Ben. I have the great joy to introduce my friend Shoto Spring, who will be giving the talk today. Shoto Spring has been practicing Zen since 1983, received the precepts from Dainin Katagiri, founder, trained at San Francisco Zen Center, San Shinji and Hokyoji, was ordained and received transmission from Shohaku Okamura, who was the interim guiding teacher after Dainin Katagiri. So we have a familial connection. Shoto's practice and teaching have been rooted in Zazen and Dogen study. Her expression is focused on engaged Buddhism, including both social justice and environmental activism. Currently, she's offering Sesshin, earth-based retreats, and online classes, as well as offering Dharma talks. She's working to create a residential practice community at her small farm in southern Minnesota, for those of you who want to get into this. Shoto is the founder of the Mountains and Waters Alliance, which proposes joining with beyond humans as colleagues to protect, nourish, and restore the living earth. And I just want to share a personal story because I've had the great joy of spending a lot of time with Shoto over the years in many different contexts. And I was trying to think of a story that would sum something up. And a couple of years ago, we were in a car traveling together to a couple of days of nonviolent direct action in northern Minnesota in solidarity with Indigenous water protectors as part of the Stop Line 3 movement. And as we were going up there, Shoto opened up the conversation of how we should care for our ceremonial robes while we're engaged in the nonviolent direct action, our ocasis. And I thought, this just summed up your commitment to integrating an embodiment of Soto Zen with protecting the earth and caring for exactly what's in front of us so perfectly. So I'm just so grateful to have you as a friend. Thank you, Shoto.
So I can start.
Yep.
So thank you for that introduction. I have been very pleased to know Ben myself. I don't remember this conversation at all. but Okamura Roshi, the first time, was it another Buddhist, another Zen person and I back in Bloomington, Indiana, were talking about going and doing a public sit. What was the subject? It might have been climate change. I don't even remember. And I spoke to my teacher about it, kind of asked permission. And he said, how will you take care of your Okesa? I went, okay, got to take care of the Okesa. It's funny because he's, on the one hand, very traditional, and on the one hand, completely radical. If those of you who are here with him remember that he came from the Zen without toys tradition, of which you've got some of that here. But there's also the matter of somebody said, look at how he handles his bowls. He handles his eating bowls as a sacred object. And that's something he transmitted to me. He wasn't the first person who transmitted that to me. But so I can't take care of my robes. And even though right now I'm not able to wear the Okesa because of the sling, but here it is, you know, sacred robe. I put it on my head and say the chant before I put it on. And there's a touch it to your forehead before you put it on the second time in the same day. And don't plop it on the ground. It's always in its case. It's always taken care of. And we name things as sacred while we come from a tradition where everything is sacred. And so part of my personal practice has been to treat plants and rocks and trees and tools also as sacred, doing the best I can. So the story I remember with Ben on that same trip, I think it's the same trip, is that there was a ceremony at the water on Friday evening, and different people were speaking from different faith traditions. And I was standing there thinking, I have no idea what I would say. It's okay, they'll call on Ben. They always call on Ben. They called on me. I still don't know why. Something came out of my mouth that seems to have been okay. So when I was thinking about this talk today, I went, okay, what shall I talk about? And this is an experienced group and so forth. And I want to talk about something that's current, something that I'm actually working with right now. And it took 5 minutes, and I thought, I guess I'll talk about fear. And then I thought, I have no idea what to say about fear. So I have found some things. And I'll start with the teachings. There's the five great fears. The fear of death, the fear of illness, the fear of losing your mind, which one person said the fear of dementia, the fear of losing your livelihood, and the fear of public speaking. So I have noticed public speaking requires a little fear. If you're not like the energy that pulls it together is necessary in order to actually be fully present. So that little incident at the lake where I was suddenly called on was an example. And then today, or maybe it was as I was going through my notes and not being so sure about them, I was like, okay. So we have fear of public speaking. And in my preparation, I read an essay by Lou Richmond, who is a California San Francisco Zen Center person. He wrote about a number of things, but he had an essay on the five great fears. And what he said, how did public speaking get in there with death? So I'm going to start there, because this is kind of familiar Dharma ground. There's a sort of a panic. There's a question of, who am I? What am I going to present to people? And this fear has to do with the self. I'm afraid because I could humiliate myself. Or even worse, I could say something that misleads people. In the Samdhi Nirmochana, there's a whole chapter on why not to speak the Dharma in certain ways that are wrong. You mislead people and they'll go to hell. That's the basic story. It's not what will happen to you. It's what damage you'll do to people. So I'm always more afraid of that than I am of embarrassing myself, which I have a lifetime fear of. So public speaking, bring this up. Oh, Lou mentioned that that the monks of Buddhist time, which is when those five great fears come from, they had to speak. You think, oh, they're just, you know, meditating and stuff like that. No, they're wandering around begging for their food. And part of what you do in begging for food is give a Dharma talk. And in that tradition, I'm pretty sure the Dharma talk is improvised, extemporaneous. So you should be ready at any moment to share the Dharma. Now, the only way this works is if the self becomes less important. So the practice of speaking is a practice of kind of, it's not that there's no fear. It's a practice of walking right into it and right through it and seeing what happens. So right now, people are looking at me and they look like they're paying attention. So all is good. I'm also recognizing a few people, which is very nice. So having started with that, now I'm going to go back to my introduction. I have been noticing fear in the world around me, a little in my personal life. It's like this thing, it's like fear, it has never hurt enough to be scary. But the fear is, what if I don't recover? I went to all that trouble. What if I don't get my functioning back? A couple of years earlier, I was diagnosed with kidney disease. And I was not only enraged, I was terrified. If you ever get a kidney disease, do not go online and read things about it. Because it's all about why you should be afraid. There's nothing you can do safely. And the instructions for what to eat are self-contradictory. And eventually I paid money to a kidney nutritionist who was not available to me through the medical system, of course. And got reassured. It's like, okay, because I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about that. And so forth and so on and so on. And the doctors think that holding stable is terrific. I'm still determined to improve. But I don't talk to the doctors about that because why waste my time? There is also the fact that in Chinese medicine, the kidney is associated with fear. And so in order to move forward, I had to ditch the fear somehow without ignoring it. You know, I could not just ignore the possibility that something could happen. That's how I wound up in surgery. But I had to use it as a guide without giving into it, without constantly being afraid. So that was actually harder in its own way than having surgery. Anyway, so that's me personally. I've had children, I have grandchildren. I have had the fear of having a child at 14 not come home until 4 in the morning. I hear that even though they have cell phones now, they turn them off. She was so surprised when she found that I was sitting up outside her bedroom door. It was years before she did it again. But, you know, we're afraid for our children right now. So I specialize in the environment and climate change. And I don't make it my business to read every single thing that is sent to me about that. Because I sort of know it doesn't help me. The details don't help me. If I were working in sciences, maybe the details would help me. Or if I were giving talks about climate, maybe I would need those details. Okay, so I'll talk a little more about that. Being afraid or worried about climate change. Now I need to talk about the difference between fear and despair, because this is an arena in which we hear a lot of utter hopelessness. And of course, we're being manipulated. The same people who 5 years ago said, there's no climate change, you're silly, are now saying, it's too late and there's nothing we can do, so go ahead and party. So I remember joining the Deep Adaptation Group because they were so hopeful. They merely thought that we were going to lose civilization. They did not think that we were going to lose all life on Earth. And that was several years ago. And things have not gotten better on the surface. Actually, but despair leads to inaction. And inaction is not good. There are all kinds of action. There's a kind of despair that people have a lot, and it crops up both in the climate stuff and in various political fears. And that is the fear of the people around us. The fear that everyone but us doesn't care, doesn't know, wants to hurt us. And we are constantly being told this from every direction. There's mainstream news, there's climate activists who fight with each other about whether to hope or not. And my position on despair in relation to climate is that on the one hand, we don't know what will happen. That's hope. We don't know what will happen. On the other hand, we need to engage. I think engagement is an antidote for fear on a very practical and human level. I'm just talking psychology, not particularly Dharma. But I think I said to somebody once, the reason given the opinions I have about what's happening, I cannot explain why I'm not more upset. But I'm not more upset. There's work to do, and it does not help me to be upset to do that work. Okay. Let me see. So, despair. So I make my living as a psychotherapist, and what I'm noticing is anxiety. I notice it in me. I just talked about it. But I also notice it in my clients. It's like the most common thing that's going on. Sometimes it's related to something that just happened, and sometimes it's just generic. And just recently, I was talking to somebody who was afraid of getting on an airplane, and we started talking about this person's fear for their child. And their child in this world that we live in, and the one that may or may not be coming, because we don't know what's happening. And I think it became clear to both of us that that fear of something that basically cannot be controlled, and parts of it don't look very good, that underlies all the rest. We live in a time of existential anxiety. I grew up in the 50s, and back then people talked about how kids were afraid of the bomb. I don't know why I missed that. Probably because I was in a parochial school and we had Jesus. I did not have the bomb drills where you hide under your desks. So I didn't grow up with existential fear. But then every generation has had something to be afraid of. And our generation merely has to be worried about the extinction of life on Earth, or possibly against living under a fascist dictator, or possibly against, you know, just lots and lots of wars. When I was going into surgery, and I was lying on a table in a very clean room surrounded by several lovely people who were actually making jokes while doing medical treatments. And I thought about one of many stories I heard, but this particular one was about a doctor who had to amputate his child's limbs without anesthesia. That's what's happening over there. And that's not a fear, that's a horror. Having access to information gives us more to be afraid of, more to be angry about, and more to do something about. Okay. So this is going its own way. And I'll just glance at the notes now and then. Let me talk about the five great fears a little more. And a little more tying it into Dharma. So, top of the list is death. And somebody pointed out, the self cannot actually imagine its own non-existence. It's just like, no. And so trying to imagine its non-existence brings you to a place of terror. So in Zen, we talk about the great death and the little deaths and all the ego deaths. And there are various instructions for practicing Zazen, but the one my teacher promotes is just Shikantaza. I mean, I started out following my breath, but just Shikantaza, just drop your thoughts. And I was just having trouble doing this. And I tried really hard because I wanted to learn his way, not all the ways that I had accumulated over the past 15, 20 years. And eventually I noticed that to drop a thought was to drop a self. I have an idea of who I am. Sometimes it's like, oh, I have wisdom. And sometimes it's like, my mind never stops running out. So I have many ideas about who I am. But to drop all of them, I started to notice the fear. When I actually engage that practice, it's like, oh, this is scary. Because if I actually drop this stuff, I won't be there anymore and have no idea of what that's like. And of course, that's the point. And that's why sitting Shikantaza is a beneficial thing. Oh, excuse me. So I've always been in the school of where Zazen has no benefits. It's good for nothing. But it's actually not true. And so practicing dropping is it's sort of like, as Dogen says, that is enlightenment itself, just to enter this practice. Drop, 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 and so forth. You just keep doing it. And maybe eventually you have a few moments or longer where it's actually quiet and your mind isn't going yap, yap, yap. And maybe you just, it's like exercising a muscle that you get better at dropping. Oh, and you get faster at noticing. I mean, first, the first thing is that you notice that your mind is going like this. So, death. About personal death, I've always thought that it's not scary, especially if it doesn't hurt. But I have a lot to do first, so I'm not eager to have that happen. Hope I get some time. Second one is illness. We do have experience. Well, some of us have experience of illness. You know, I've had a few things. I've had the flu. I haven't had COVID. I've had pneumonia a few times. And so injury is not the same as illness, but it's like everything changes. The whole world, your world changes when you're sick or when you're injured. And we don't like that and we don't want it to happen. We want our lives to continue. Okay. And I think the fear of dementia is even bigger than the fear of illness. Or, oh, and there's the fear of permanent illness. I've always been in favor of get better if you can. I just think that's a better plan. But this dementia thing, there was a quote again. I didn't type out all this stuff, everything is harder to do. So I wrote bad handwriting. So I read something where a great teacher from, I think, Hindu tradition said, you know, people are demented. The Buddha nature is still there. They're still there. And I read that, and I remembered when my mother was dying, and I spent a month with her in assisted living, and the people, she and the other people with her, all had dementia. That's why they were there. And I started noticing some people, there was just a light in their eyes. And I looked at my mother, and there was a light in her eyes. And I looked at, there was a very tall woman. I don't remember. There was a light in her eyes. And they couldn't remember anything. My mother was better than most people. She still like knew who I was and so forth. But I'd look at these people who couldn't remember their life stories, and they were glowing. And this teacher, whose name I forget, that's what he said. Buddha nature is luminosity. It doesn't go away even if our mind isn't functioning. It certainly doesn't go away if our body isn't functioning, or maybe isn't functioning well. And seeing that made me less worried about losing my own mind. I'm still opposed to it. And then we have loss of livelihood. And I think it's funny. I'm looking around me at society. And on the one hand, during the pandemic, a lot of people changed their relationship with livelihood. And some of them didn't go back to their jobs. I do not know what they're living on. I also know that during the pandemic, the amount of money, the amount of wealth held by the richest of the rich escalated by factors of 10. And the minimum wage is still $7.50. And people are quite poor. Food shelves are thriving. Homeless people are everywhere, not counting refugees, people who are homeless just because they're poor. The kind of people whose kids live in a van and their kids never miss a day at school and get straight A's. Those people too. And the ones who are mentally ill and or drinking or whatever. I would say there's a lot of fear of loss of livelihood because it's not a crazy fear, it's a realistic fear. And in this society, most of us, if we lose our jobs, will be in trouble. And that's a difference between, I'll say, a modern capitalist society, not speaking to any older kinds of societies, and a tribal society where somebody will take you in, or where people will bring you food. The level at which we know tribalism now is mostly in our families and in smallish groups where people will take care of each other. Oh, and thank you for bringing me. Since I can't drive, I'm getting lots of rides. from people in my community. Okay. So it seems to me that we live in a world in which there's a lot to literally be afraid of. There's the climate thing, there's the political thing, you know, and people are disappearing and people are being shot. That young man, Aaron, who set himself on fire rather than be deployed to Gaza. Two police came up to him. One of them had a fire extinguisher and the other one was holding a gun on him. And of course, many of us were shocked. And then somebody said, well, he could have been holding a grenade. I'm still not sure what good the gun would have done. But it's like everyone's afraid of everyone. I only lock my doors at night, but I live in the country. You know, I've checked out all my neighbors. If I lived in the city, I would be more interested in locking my doors. And so there are a lot, there are personal things to be afraid of about livelihood, safety, and health. And what I want to address now is that how we manage our lives based on fear. What do we manage our life based on? So I mentioned locking the door. And so we came to the city, and the question was, is it safe to leave the backpack in the car? Is it safe to leave the wallet on the shelf, the shoe shelves? Because I've known Zen centers that had theft problems. And I don't know the story here and now. So we have to manage that. And then there's this other thing, which is a kind of a sense in how the universe works. And against those specifics, there is the question of how does the universe work? Where is support? The matter of, sometimes it's called emptiness, sometimes it's called interdependence, which is a little clearer. But the way in which we exist is, I think, the greatest comfort. So moment by moment, each of us is created. We're created by everything and everyone around us, and we're created by our history, and particularly our deeds. The action of karma is how my action today creates my life of tomorrow. We also create the things around us. So it's completely mutual. We are all always creating each other. The universe speaks us into existence. And the question of whether we listen for that word that speaks us into existence, I think it's a matter between peace and anxiety. Long time ago, I met people who were doing radical things. One of them was running a hospitality house, and he had homeless people sleeping, you know, everywhere, including in his bedroom. And he had a light in his eyes. And I was like, impressed. I was like, how do those two things go together? That might be one of the things that made me interested in not just having an ordinary life, which would be more comfortable. There's a trust that somehow things are okay. Now, Christians do this by trusting in God, but we don't do that. And we don't trust Buddha in that way either. But unless you say the whole universe is the Buddha body, and then we could say that we're trusting Buddha. But it's sort of a not complaining. It's letting things be how they are. And so now a word about hope. I run in crowds where hope is a dirty word. And I run in crowds where hope is like it. Katagiri said something bad about hope once. And then 6 months later, he said something good about hope. So one of the definitions of hope is that we're expecting something outside to come and save us. I have taken, when I write, I've taken to calling that false hope. It's like, you don't want that kind. You don't want to think that somebody will save you. or somebody that's not you will save you. But then there's the hope that is, we don't know the future. We don't know all the parts and we don't know all the players. So to give up now, it's just, what can I say? It's like out of touch with reality. It's assuming that we know everything. I don't know everything. I don't think anybody here thinks they know everything about what's going to happen. So the hope that's possibility, the hope that our actions might actually have some effect, the hope that we're actually not alone. Because we're not alone, we're part of the family. So if we have an assumption that somebody else will help us or that nobody will help us, we're frozen. We're creating a universe. We're creating an idea of how the universe works. And then we have to protect ourselves from that universe. I'm going to throw in a few things from the external world. In 2020, science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson wrote a book called Ministry for the Future. And he imagined, in this book, he imagines how we could get from a state of basically disaster to a state of recovery, actually changing life on Earth to back away from climate change. It was focused on climate change. And it was amazing. It was also encouraging because something that can be imagined could conceivably happen. And then I ran across by a talk by him at Bioneers just last year. And he says, oh, things are so much better now. Now, they don't look better to me, you know? There are more floods, more droughts, more dead people, more wars. He said, there's more awareness. And the more awareness, more people are aware of climate change, more people are interested in doing something about it. And then he mentioned a couple of things that had actually been in his book, something with the central banks are doing that none of us know about. You'll have to look them up online, as I can't explain it and it wouldn't be worth our time. But the International Monetary Fund, who kind of makes their living lending money to small countries and destroying them with the rules and the interest, they now have a special fund for rescuing small countries that doesn't have to be repaid. Really? These are the bad guys, and they're doing something like that. All right. Well, one of those climate conferences, the ones that never do anything, apparently did that. I can't read that. And he talks about looking, you see all these waves, you know, and so the waves we see are more deaths, more police brutality, more of every good deed, no good deed goes unpunished. We see this on the surface, and he says, look underneath. And I think part of the reason I'm more optimistic than most people is because underneath is where I always look. That's where I've been. And so the list of, if I go to a Zen conference or a spirituality conference, and I talk about asking for help from the trees and the mountains and the rivers, there's always some people smiling and nodding. It's like, oh. I mean, I know it's consistent with the Buddhist teaching, but that I'm not the first one to think of it. It's like, yes. So So the requirement is to be engaged and not to despair. Is always beckoning as an excuse for laziness, just as somebody else will do it is an excuse for laziness. I took a lot of hope. I'll do a despair thing, and then I'll stop for questions or discussion. So I have certain opinions about elections, and some of those opinions have to do with the war in Gaza and our tax dollars supporting that war. And, you know, I want a different candidate, right? And so the despair part is the number of people who refuse to cast a differentiating vote in the primary because they can't tell the difference between the primary and the general election. But the encouragement is how many people actually voted uncommitted in the primary, sending a message, in case anybody's listening, that says, no, we're opposed to the war. Everybody knows that that uncommitted vote means we do not want to wage war on Gaza, or probably anybody else. So that's both the temptation towards despair and towards hating people, you know? Why can't you be smarter? Well, not being smart is never a good reason to hate people. So, okay. Closing, some kind of closing. I will just say, impermanence and interdependence are our friend. The community of all beings is where we live. It's not just Minnesotans. It's not just humans. It's not the all beings. I feel supported. And, you know, if you put your hands physically in the dirt, that's an antidepressant. I mean, there have been many studies, right? Okay, so there are, we have lots of friends. And the challenge is for us to act like friends. And I don't know. I used to say, you know, when I think about my grandchildren, I just want them to have air and water and food. But now I have a little more of a vision because I think those things are very much at risk. But now I have a little more of a vision, and I want them to live in, you know, a community of people and to love and be loved and to get off their phones. And, you know, it's like there are a lot of ways to have a good life. And they don't have to be Buddhists. This is like, I think Buddhism is enormously helpful in its teachings, but they don't have to be Buddhists. That's not important. I want them to be present. I want them to know that they're surrounded by love. And to be able to have that when things get hard, because that'll happen too. Okay. Comments and questions. Mm-hmm. Oh, in the chat. How do we tell the difference between I'm being lazy, I don't feel moved towards action, and I'm not in a place to help, and that's okay? Oh my gosh, Jeff, that, I don't know who Jeff is, but that is the question. I struggle with that question all the time. Right now, I am excused. My email is always full of like 10 or 20 opportunities, and some of them are learning opportunities and spiritual opportunities and this and that. And some of them are opportunities. You know, there's something called deep canvassing, which actually helps people. Well, I don't know, because I didn't go to the training. I read a little blurb about it. This is a good thing to do to actually change things in the election. And there's, or I don't feel moved towards action, and I'm not in a place to help. I'm thinking about Rosebud Reservation. Let's pick Rosebud. So I was involved in opposing the KXL pipeline more than 10 years ago now. And one of the stories I heard, so we walked along the pipeline and we went through a lot of what's called Indian country. And somebody told us about Rosebud. So the pipeline company comes in and makes a donation or brings business. And there was a small town that we stopped at that had this lovely community center that was donated by the pipeline company. So that's how they make friends, you know? From their point of view, it's pretty cheap. So Rosebud Reservation, one of the poorest places in the country. I mean, seriously. The pipeline company offered them a contract. I forget what it was. They were going to buy something. I think Rosebud had solar panels. But anyway, they were going to buy something from Rosebud to bring prosperity, food for their children, health, that stuff that you really need. They said no. They said, we will not destroy the earth in exchange for our own children's well-being. So, and that, I'm still amazed by that. I've always said, you got to take care of your children. You got to do this. You know, there are people who are excused. I've also met people who, put themselves in harm's way, opposing the pipeline in northern Minnesota. And well, some of them got COVID. That was in the first year of COVID. But I didn't meet anybody who lost a limb. I probably have met people who experienced pain and who knew they could be killed. I know people who risked their lives for that and who risked their limbs for that. So not being lazy isn't a very good motivator. Oh, here's a motivator. I spent most of my life saying, no, I can't do that. That's somebody else's to do, or something like that. And when, about 2004, I had been at Tassajara. And, you can't do activism from Tassajara. You can chant. And, there are various things you can do when you can't go do something physically. And then I left there. And I spent a few months involved in electoral politics. And when was it? My resume. Okay. Anyway, I had a vision of sitting Zazen outside of the conventions. And that vision was kind of strong. And I did it. Okay, I went to Boston. We sat outside the DNC in a lovely park. We had anywhere from 3 to 5 to 8 people out there. And the public walked by. Some of them, a lot of them got Zazen instruction. Some of them asked questions. Some of them tried to evangelize us. And then we walked from Boston to New York with a anarchist group. And then we did sitting again in New York, which was harder because we were much farther from the convention. Circumstances were difficult. Doing the thing that I felt tempted to do made an enormous difference. And so then instead of trying not to be lazy, it's like, oh, this is really good. I love doing this. Doing the Compassion to Earth Walk along the Keystone Pipeline. That was a matter of, I was sitting in the Zendo and I started seeing pictures on the wall and they wouldn't go away. And so eventually I wound up organizing and leading a bunch of people to walk along the pipeline. I have never felt so alive in my life. I really miss it. I would love to do that again. And right now I can't. I'm working on a book. I'm doing these little things. And I constantly go, oh, I should go up to that protest, or I should go up and testify at that, you know, hearing, or I really should go up and lock down on the pipeline. I think the book is going to be valuable. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you can't do everything. You have to have some sense of reasonableness. I don't know, Jeff, how is this? Is this working?
So I think the first part of the question, if you're able to hear me, the first part of the about being lazy is I am afraid that I am being lazy. The second part is whether or not, like, this is what the still small voice within tells me that is, you know, my path, or this is the cause that I should feel inspired to do something about, because, you know, I can't be protesting Palestine and, you know, packing dehydrated meals. And it kind of leads to this paralysis of doing nothing. And then, you know, there's the, you know, if I haven't been able to work for a while, you know, I'm not necessarily perhaps mentally or financially in a place to give much, and recognizing, you know, that's actually why I feel okay being like inactive, for example.
Yeah, there are a lot of right things to do. And I struggle with this like all the time. Every time I hit delete on some urgent call to action that's going to save the world. And, you know, I just have to go, okay, I can't do everything. Oh, one of the things I learned when I was in Movement for New Society was there are lots of us and we don't all have to do the same things. But then sometimes it's like, so you're plugging away at your everyday thing. And, you know, if you're doing something that enables you to give money, that's huge. Because so many of us don't want to do that. But like, treat yourself now and then and do something that satisfies the urge. That's my thought. Anyway. Thank you so much for that question. And I can try to give shorter answers, by the way. Yes. Loudly.
You mentioned thinking, and that sometimes is a part of it. You know, this thinking is the real problem. And yeah, we see so much thinking in your own talk and all these activisms. So is there a way to distinguish you know, I mean, the way I would be, you know, grasping or clutching at thinking this has got to happen, this should happen, as opposed to, yeah, it should happen. But is there a way to kind of distinguish between clutching and grasping at thinking and thinking itself?
Good question. Very, very good. It's like that is a major thing. Thinking versus grasping. So thinking is just a thing that happens in our brains, you know? It's not actually good or bad. Grasping is part of the 12 chain cause of how we make suffering. And what else? So we have, forgive me if I contradict something I said earlier. It happens. Now I forgot what I was going to say.
So even with your, you know, Uchiyama, I don't know if it's Sawaki or Uchiyama, but even like that origami that they did, all the thought in that origami, and the non-thought, but the thought, the non-thought of that origami.
You brought it back. Okay, so in order to live in everyday life, we need cognitive thinking. In order to find peace, we need not to be controlled by cognitive thinking. Did you ever hear of Jill Bolton Taylor, who wrote a book called My Stroke of Insight? So she was a neuroscientist of some kind, and she had a stroke. So she knew how the brain worked. She knew what was happening to her. And so she using her right brain, she managed to dial the phone and get help. And she talks about being just immersed in bliss. It was so nice. She wasn't sure she wanted to come back. But she managed to remember some of the pleasures of the cognitive mind, known as the left brain. And so she did the work to come back from a stroke. Yes.
You mentioned false hope. And I'm a little bit from the side of last thing Pandora released was hope. That's a bad thing. But what I do have, or what I try to have, is faith in a process that we can figure it out. Could you perhaps talk about the difference of those two things?
Well, so false hope is somebody else is going to do it. I mean, that's the way I'm using it briefly.
Or magic.
Or magic.
A miracle.
Well, so what's interesting is I spend a lot of my time in the realm of magic or miracles. For instance, if we chant for somebody to get well, well, you could talk about, some people talk about subtle energies, you know. I mean, Alan Sinaki is coming back to his mind after having that stroke, after being unconscious or semi-conscious for weeks. And that looks like a miracle to me. And I'll bet there were thousands of people chanting for him. So that's my own personal diversion into magic and miracles, which goes with prayer. And it's not prayer in the thoughts and prayers, which means I'm not doing anything. It's the prayer like, oh, I'm going to sit up all night or climb to the top of the sacred mountain and offer these things and, you know, fast and all this stuff. And it's like you're actually putting some energy out there. Or, you know, I'm going to sit a 7-day sesshin and dedicate, you know, all the merit at the end. I just said something false, but never mind. So the process is, the process is the thing. I mean, there is nothing but process. And so the second thing you said, you have faith that the process will work. Yeah, I would say that's what I'm talking about. But you can add something if you'd like. Okay, thanks. Yes. Okay. It's 11 o'clock. Well, thank you all. This has been great fun.